Welcome to Business Watch, and time to talk about the brass tacks of banking. Nedbank was the first out of the blocks yesterday with an eye-catching 81% increase in its dividend, as all eyes are on the local banking earnings, which are underway in August. Primarily, retail credit applications rejections are at all-time highs amidst historically high application levels in South Africa, and South Africa's banks are likely to continue to focus on originating secured credit considering the stable asset prices in the residential housing market and increasing risks obviously to unsecured credit portfolios as interest rates increase ahead of expectations. Capital is certainly not an issue for South Africa's banks. I think the issues are confidence and growth, or rather a lack thereof. So it's a great pleasure to welcome back Nolwandle Mthombeni, who is Senior Banks Analyst at Intellidex, and David Buckham, MD of Monocle, to run the rule over the banks, as always. Nolwandle, let's start with the stat of the month, and obviously with July being savings month, Intellidex took a look into retail deposits in South Africa's big banks. What does it reveal?
So our banking indicator is up till May, so that's one of the latest figures. And in the composition of the index, we focus on the balance sheet and the income statement as well as return and profitability. And the latest metrics reveal that there's still some good momentum if you look at revenue, as far as non-interest revenue items and non-interest income. And there's also now some good growth in terms of loans and actual loan growth. And deposit growth is also tracking well. On the other side of the coin, though, we see some slowing momentum in impairments, which tells us that, you know, before the recovery, which had been the whole of last year, but, you know, there's some base effects that are starting to play out. But also, we've seen that there's some pressure coming through in terms of impairments, and that we're not seeing an improvement, but rather they're starting to now increase. So far it looks like, and you know, the results that we started seeing with the banks come through, is that it is in fact happening, that the impairments are rising. There's more provisions being put on as a result of the very much poorer outcome. Yeah. As far as how in terms of savings month and how deposits are going, they're still, you know, towering through very strongly, and we're seeing some growth coming through. But it has slowed down in the beginning of the year, but some momentum is improving as far as deposits are concerned.
And we see here that First Rand still leads in deposits. Absa has been chasing it down, and the laggard really has been Nedbank, followed closely probably by Standard Bank. Capitec is growing, but not growing its asset base commensurately here. What stands out for you, David, when you look at the retail deposit situation in South Africa?
I think it's very interesting. It's an indication that the model for banking, the business model for banking, is shifting and has shifted over the last, I would say, decade, is that more and more banks are becoming more reliant on NIR, non-interest revenue, and less on asset growth, and are battling over deposits as a kind of endowment effect and a cheaper way of financing themselves. And also, this is a function of the liquidity rules as per Basel III, which was the HQLA, the high quality liquid assets. So in the great battle for retail deposits, it would appear that Nedbank has fallen behind, and has also fallen behind to some extent in terms of non-interest revenue. So the model for banking has shifted to a risk-off model, and it would appear that Nedbank has suffered on that count. As far as kind of more broadly, the numbers which are staggering should be taken with a pinch of salt, because it comes off a low base. So I would say that on the face of it, a 26% increase in profitability for Nedbank is very good. But my concern would be, in general, a shift away from serious lending would appear to be towards fee-based income and deposits.
And I was chatting, Nolwandle, yesterday to Mike Brown about this decline that we've seen in the retail book, and supported to some extent or counterbalanced by growth in SME deposits. And he pointed to more the quality of that book being of primary concern. But from a capital perspective, and to my introductory remarks, Tier 1 capital, I think, at 13.5. The target was between 11 and 12 percent. So well above the, its tier one capital targets, and clearly capital and cash flush at the moment. So it's not like the banks won't be able to fund a big renewable build-out, for example. I suppose the question is, can we get the infrastructure to get those electrons from the power stations to the customers at the end of the day? But what stood out for you in the Nedbank numbers?
I mean, it's definitely that bump in the dividend, where they decided to, use some of that capital that they've built up in excess capital and decide to, sweeten the results with a higher than expected payout ratio. So they came out at the lower end of the payout ratio, and they had the dividend grow much faster than earnings. So, given that the earnings only grew by 26%, you really expect that, the market would have expected that the dividend would grow by the same quantum. But I think, one of the things they had to consider is that their earnings are still below pre-pandemic levels, which is, it's a negative sign if you compare them to the peers who all have earnings above. So I think in terms of also managing the market expectations, I think the dividend also had a big role to play in that, because there are lagging peers from an earnings perspective and recovery perspective if we look at how they're still far behind in terms of the earnings recovery. But, investors will always welcome a dividend, especially in this environment where there's a lot of volatility and the price returns are very low. Mm. So the market will cheer it now and, look over the other things, given the fact that, the market is very volatile. Good dividend growth is, always safe for investors.
And also given what we saw during the pandemic period, partly because of what the regulator imposed and just partly because of sound prudential management to either withhold or significantly reduce the dividend. If you look at, let's move globally, and we'll come back to the outlook for the rest of the banks later on. But if we look globally, the other theme obviously in markets continues to be central banks. And David, what we saw yesterday in the US was inflation come in slightly lighter than what the market expected, and we saw a huge relief rally on the back of this. Does this indicate potentially that there is now space for the Fed and other central banks to maybe pull up the handbrake for a little bit, say wait and see? Or does this mean that, well, the economy is strong and robust, so we can continue to be aggressive with our rate cycle? I mean, how do you read it?
Well, Michael, first of all, I got it wrong. I was convinced that it would be higher than 9.1 and that it would continue to go up but to decelerate. So for me, the number is very surprising. It's a very good sign. And if you align it with the jobs data number, the 528,000 new jobs, which was out last week, the labor stat, and the lowest unemployment rate pretty much in recent decades, 3.5%. It's very difficult to anticipate which way they should go. So there's two narratives. On the one hand, the one narrative would be the data is messy and it was messed up by the fuel price decrease. The fact that the NASDAQ rallied 20% over the last month is distressing, and we're back to kind of this overinflated market. So that's the one rally. The one narrative, which is that they should keep tightening and they should do it to prevent recession, or even if we go into a recession, which technically they have already, we need to stop the inflation train and long embedded inflation. That's the one narrative. The second narrative is you see guys, tightening works, it's all over, we put out the fire, everything's fine, no problems for us. So I'm in the first narrative, but the number of 8.5% coming down from 9.1% in a period of a month for an annual number is extremely surprising. Coupled with the jobs data, sometimes I have to admit I was wrong. So I eagerly await the next data point, which would be a month from now. If that's below 8.5, I think the Fed is doing a good job, which is extremely surprising. And they could avoid a recession. This has global implications, especially for South Africa. If they're able to tame inflation, it means that we're not going to suffer from as severe imported inflation as I would have originally expected. So, honestly, Michael, very surprised by the 8.5.
And no one let, just to build on that as well, I suppose a question is how the SAR will react to what the Fed has also done recently with Jay Powell seemingly channeling his inner Volcker, containing inflation at potentially looks like for now, and also saying we're going to go meeting to meeting and not giving a firm guidance anymore. What do you read into that?
So, you know, the first, you know, interesting point that you made was that, you know, at some point they have to stop and assess whether the policy intervention has been working. So already the Fed is starting to think, okay, we've done quite a lot in a short space of time, but, you know, we need to actually have a pause moment where we're going to see, is this actually working? So I think that, you know, the first stance of, you know, coming through with hawkish tones about 50 to 75 basis points was good because it set that expectation in the market. And as we know, inflation is all about expectations. So now going forward, we can see now that it's starting to change the rhetoric a bit to say, look, we've done a lot, but at some point we're going to have to now assess. The interesting thing is that, you know, there's many reports that came out as early as yesterday to say that July might be the peak for inflation. If that's the case, we can definitely expect the Fed to, you know, be in a position to say, okay, now we need to actually see if this is working, given that we think that inflation has peaked. If you look at what SARB is going to doing, it's so weird because we find ourselves in positions where last month was the hike and expect another one next month. So I don't think the SARB is going to not go ahead with the hike next month. I think they're still going to continue, but they are also very much data driven. So if inflation expectations are for that it'll peak in July, as reports came out yesterday suggest, it means that, you know, the outlook is that, you know, maybe there'll be adjustments to the outlook as well, and we're going to see, you know, less aggressive hikes. The 75 was obviously extreme, and there was even a vote for a 100 basis points hike. But I think we're going to have maybe, you know, relief and go back to the 50 basis points level that is being expected for the next two hikes within this year.
Yeah, I wish we
so that's
published.
What's going to happen.
Yeah, I wish we published minutes so we could understand the reason behind one of the FOMC members voting, well, not the FOMC, the MPC, voting for a 100-point hike. David, you're in New York at the moment. You spoke about the two narratives around inflation. You know, what is the sense on the ground? What is the mood like in New York and in America around the job, firstly, that the Fed is doing, and the political mood around a president who seems to be under a lot of pressure? His ratings are declining, are Joe Biden's, and you've got Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago home raided by the DOJ. It all seems very combustible.
Yeah, I think it's gone crazy. I mean, the markets are roaring again. I mean, not Bitcoin, but Nasdaq is up 20%. Trump has got, so they've raided his home, a 9-hour search. There's not much detail on what they were looking for. Fox News, kind of Hannity, Sean Hannity's loving this. And it's they're talking about a 3-point gain just off this for 2024. They view Biden's behavior as, the anything that Biden does is very negative. You've seen recently the new bill come through, that went through Senate, and they had to give up, the governor of Arizona had to give up certain tax, the senators in Arizona on the Democratic side had to give up taxing the billionaires and the hedge fund managers. So the mood is very much a kind of American style, revolutionary style. It's very bipartisan. And it's quite scary. I've never seen America this divided.
And that is disturbing. It's a trend that we've been tracking, and certainly seems to be increasing as we head into that 2024 election. You mentioned Bitcoin. No wonder. I think central bank digital currencies have been spoken about at length over the last 2 years. And clearly, I think the advantages are that they tackle one of the big issues around global payments and remittances, and that's bringing down the cost and making it easier and more effective. You know, there was a World Bank report that I was reading that it costs the average Tanzanian worker a quarter of their salary to remit what they earn back home. So it's an interesting development. What stood out for you over the last while in the world of central bank digital currencies?
So, yes, I think it's very interesting that remittances remain so costly. It's, you know, we've seen all costs area of everything in transactions fall, but remittances remain stubbornly high cost payment system. So what development, what central banks are using, you know, they're piloting many projects across different regions and different central banks to kind of have a cross-border type of payment system, which will help, for example, to ease, you know, to make the remittance market much easier from in terms of efficiency as well as more cost-effective. And we've seen that they've been making a lot of progresses. But, you know, besides having, you know, digital currency, I also think that they also want to have a better understanding what's happening in terms of cryptos as well, because some of that technology is the same used for, you know, the likes of Bitcoin. So they also have the advantage of learning the systems and different payment methods and the Bitcoins and how those technologies work. So it also works to the advantage in how different, you know, shadow banking could happen. So as much as it is about remittances, but there's also elements of understanding exactly how these new cryptocurrencies work. And as we're seeing is that there's many, you know, progress going through, but there's also many nuances. For example, there's different currencies to deal with, you know, to implement a system that caters to different currencies and different cross-border payments and different systems, and to integrate all of these is going to be very difficult. So each different project, you know, tackles different aspects of the different challenges, and we're seeing that, you know, at least they're getting, you know, building blocks of being there, but this is really a multi-year process of getting through. And but we're seeing that even, you know, South Africa now Reserve Bank is involved in a project which is, you know, has had good outcomes and has had, you know, many trials and feasibility studies, and we expect that the continuing momentum to happen. But it's going to be a multi-year process. It's not something that happens overnight.
Yeah, Project Dunbar, I think 13 CBD projects that are either underway or completed around the world. What are the challenges, as you view it from your perspective, David, when it comes to introducing a central bank digital currency?
So I think that one has to delineate very carefully between the concept of a digital currency and a cryptocurrency. So a cryptocurrency would be based on blockchain technology, which would be consensus that is distributed and decentralized, which is completely unnecessary if it's driven by the central bank. So it's counterintuitive to have a central bank digital currency that's based on blockchain technology. It's completely counterintuitive. So what I perceive there to be rules pertaining to digital currencies that are not based on decentralized consensus, that are based on centralized governance, just like currencies are today, for example, the South African rand. So I think the two ideas sometimes get conflated. I don't think that the SARB is unaware of this. They're very much aware that they need to put legislation in place as it pertains to ExCon and tax, etc., etc., identifying the end user as it pertains to cryptocurrency. But there are also very strong arguments for there to be a more efficient way to do cross-border transactions through a digital currency. My personal view is that why not make our actual currency more able to be efficient for cross-border transactions and put very hardcore cryptocurrency legislation in place to help manage and regulate money laundering, counter-financing of terrorism, and put the same rules in place for crypto, would be my argument.
Yeah, I mean, on that point, and I wonder, just to build on that, we had the Prudential Authority out with a very interesting report a couple of weeks ago, just looking at those money laundering and terrorism financing risks that some of the big banks are exposed to, and found that there are serious gaps here, and there are material risks. Again, chatting to Mike Brown of Nedbank yesterday about this, he said, yes, and within the broad framework of FATF that we need to comply with to avoid the grey listing, he likened it to a relay race. He says the banks are only one member of a four-man relay team, and they raise a suspicious transaction, they raise a FIC report, they then hand the baton to FIC, who then investigates and potentially hands it to the investigating authority, and then finally the fourth person in the relay race are the prosecuting authority. And he reckons the banks are probably the strongest runner in the race, and it's the other three really that are the big weakness at the moment. How do you read it?
I have to concur with Mike on that one. I mean, you know, we've got very strong AML and CFT provisions in place and systems. And, you know, the regulation around that is very tight. I mean, if you talk to any of the banks, the kind of systems they've had to implement, you know, the filing, it's actually a regulatory burden for them to comply. Mm. But they've all been coming to the party and been doing that. And, you know, SARB, you know, frequently has an assessment for AML, CFT across the banking sector. So this was the second report. And I think also there's that pressure from the FATF, the FATF grey listing to kind of, you know, do it now in this timing and also, you know, find some weaknesses. But, you know, what the Prudential Authority found is that, you know, many of these weaknesses are very common. For example, the biggest risks were found among the big banks and the foreign controlled banks, and the medium to small banks were less of a risk. So, and that's to be expected. And if you think about a foreign controlled bank, I mean, one of the risks they found is that, you know, there's a risk that they could have, you know, access to different jurisdictions. But I think that's not common to South Africa. It's common to any kind of bank. And, you know, even in terms of, you know, how there's more digitization across the big banks, that also seem, you know, sort of a risk. But that's not new. So the weaknesses that have found themselves within the South African financial system and within the South African banks were not unique to South Africa. That shows you that we don't have these, you know, structural problems in our banking system that makes us much higher risk from an AML, CBA, CFT point. Mm. It really is, as Mike indicated, you know, the other players in the relay race that are probably holding us back. But naturally, there will be weaknesses within any financial system and any banking system as far as, you know, anti-money laundering and terrorist financing will be.
Mm.
And, you know, some of them are very difficult to challenge. But I think it's more about being aware where the weaknesses are and how to mitigate them as far as possible.
And, you know, building on that, David, how important is this for us here in South Africa, the potential threat of a financial grey listing? I mean, you consult broadly and globally. Is this an issue that is now raised with, you know, foreign banks or foreign businesses looking to invest or do business into South Africa?
It's a very serious threat. If you think of, for example, visa requirements for South African travelers, you know, if you go back 30 years, we used to be able to travel, work in the UK for 2 years. We used to have much more freedom of movement as South Africans. And because of an erosion of trust that the world has in South African institutions, the same could happen in the banking sphere. So we could get, we grey-listed, but we could be effectively blacklisted by large international banks, which will impact us incredibly. So, for example, cost of financing, not trading in the US dollar in certain jurisdictions, and we could find ourselves inadvertently cut off from the international financial system, not completely, but just from the really good bits of it, and it will happen without a thought. There would be no reason for them to give us a free pass. There's nothing specifically special about South Africa as an economy that the international financial institutions will care about. They want to stop the financing of terrorism. They don't want risk in their counterparty banks. We saw that when they implemented the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act of the U.S., the very hardcore implementation which African banks struggled with. You know, we struggled with. So I think the banks in South Africa are trying to alert us to the risks, and it's an institutional failure if we let it happen.
Yeah, I really hope that we can avoid that ahead of the deadline in October. And then just as we conclude, looking into our crystal ball at what to expect from the rest of bank earnings season on one day, if you look at it on the valuation front, South African banks look really cheap relative to their own history, looking at the price to book charts and dividend yields on average at 5.6%. There's lots to like here. What are you going to be looking for in ABSA and Standard Bank's results coming up next week?
So the first thing is to, you know, get a handle in terms of the provisions that have been raised. Are they because the books have become riskier, or is it because of the outlook? So, you know, sometimes, you know, these two get, you know, there's a gray area, you can't tell. But I think if you look within, you know, detailed book into the books, you can see whether Have they written any bad credit? The second thing, which is quite interesting that I saw from the Nedbank results, is that there's an upward revision of industry credit growth. So as much as the environment is looking much riskier and there's more uncertainty, you know, there's some commentary made that, you know, the renewable energy will kind of give a little kicker to corporate earnings, corporate growth, and corporate appetites for lending. So that should be something that you look out for to see whether are the other banks on the same page, and are they, or do they also think that the credit industry credit growth is actually going to be higher than expected for the second half of this year.
Yeah, in the FM, Rentsho van Tonder was quoted as saying the potential is between 500 and 800 billion rand in terms of lending into this energy space at the moment. So that's a serious tailwind. David, what about asset quality in a rising interest rate environment? Do you expect the banks to start just tightening those taps a little bit just to ensure that they don't incur an NPL storm in the next few years?
I think there'll be some kind of endowment effect of the size of the spread will benefit the banks, and they'll therefore be able to take a little more risk in theory. So I'm hoping that the carry trade remains attractive, that the US tames inflation and that we don't import it, and that we get the benefit of, in the banking sector, rising interest rates could strangely be quite good for our economy, because it could increase the risk of the banks. Mm. However, when we see the overdependence on NIR, that's for the opposite argument. So I'm not sure. I'm very keen on seeing the next three. The next two banks.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got ABSA on Monday, Standard Bank on Friday. Should prove another interesting week in the world of banking and finance. Thank you very much. That was David Buckham, the CEO of Monocle Solutions, joined by Nolwandle Mthombeni, Senior Banks Analyst at Intellidex, running the rule over the banking sector here on Business Watch.